A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's deeply personal. He was born in Ireland, moved to Israel for religious reasons, and he describes the immigrant experience as a kind of voluntary backward social evolution. You go from having generations of built-up networks that protect you from the worst of society to being zero. No language, no connections, no reputation. And he's noticed that immigrants tend to split into two camps. There are the enclave builders, the people who recreate a piece of home, the Irish pub in New York, the American-style bar in Tel Aviv. Then there are the full immersionists, the ones whose Hebrew is so perfect you'd never guess they weren't born here. His question is simple. Do these two strategies have names in the sociological literature? And does one group actually report higher satisfaction and success than the other?
This is one of those questions where the answer is both incredibly well-studied and surprisingly counterintuitive, and I love that he framed it around the feeling of being a zero, because that's not just poetry. Sociologists have a name for that exact sensation.
Of course they do.
They call it status loss, or sometimes downward social mobility upon migration. There's a researcher named Ilana Redstone Akresh who published a really influential paper on this in 2008. She found that immigrants routinely lose occupational prestige when they move, even when their income goes up. A doctor from Mumbai driving a cab in Chicago is earning more than he did back home, but he's lost his status. And that psychological wound is real. The phrase Daniel used, backward social evolution, is actually a pretty perfect lay translation of what the literature describes.
That feeling of being zeroed out isn't just whining. It's a documented phenomenon.
And it happens because social capital is almost entirely non-transferable across borders. Your reputation, your professional network, your understanding of how the system works, who to call when something goes wrong, all of that evaporates the moment you get on the plane. Pierre Bourdieu, the French sociologist, wrote about this extensively. Social capital is context-dependent. It's not a suitcase you can pack.
Which brings us to the two strategies Daniel identified. The enclave builder and the immersionist. Do they have formal names?
They do, and the terminology goes back nearly a century. The broader framework is called acculturation theory, and the term acculturation was first formally defined in 1936 by three anthropologists, Redfield, Linton, and Herskovitz. They described it as the phenomenon that occurs when groups of individuals from different cultures come into continuous first-hand contact with subsequent changes in the original cultural patterns of either or both groups.
1936. So we've been arguing about this for almost 90 years.
Longer if you count the actual lived experience. But the specific two strategies Daniel described map onto a few different frameworks. The enclave builder is what sociologists call ethnic retention or cultural preservation. When it involves economic activity, it's formally called ethnic economy participation. That's a term from Alejandro Portes and Leif Jensen, who did foundational work on this in the late 80s and early 90s.
He's the segmented assimilation guy, right?
Yes, and we'll get to that because it's crucial for understanding the second generation. But first, the immersionist strategy. That maps to assimilation, sometimes called acculturation in the older literature, though those terms have slightly different meanings depending on who you're reading. Milton Gordon, in his 1964 book, Assimilation in American Life, laid out seven stages of assimilation, from cultural assimilation to civic assimilation. His framework is still taught today.
So it's not just learn the language and you're done?
Not even close. Gordon's stages include structural assimilation, which is entering the clubs and institutions of the host society, marital assimilation, identificational assimilation, which is when you stop thinking of yourself as Irish or Israeli and start thinking of yourself as American. Full assimilation in his model takes generations. And here's where it gets interesting. Daniel asked whether one group reports higher satisfaction. The answer is genuinely complicated, and it depends entirely on which metric you're measuring and when you measure it.
All right, let's break that down. What does the data actually say?
There was a major meta-analysis published in 2023 by Nguyen and Benin Martinez in the Journal of Cross-Cultural Psychology. They looked at 83 studies across 22 countries. And they found something that sounds like a paradox, but actually makes perfect sense once you think about it. The integration strategy, which means maintaining your heritage culture while also adopting the host culture, correlated with the highest psychological well-being. But the assimilation strategy, full immersion, correlated with the highest economic mobility within a single generation.
Happiness and money don't track together.
Not in the short to medium term. The enclave strategy reduces what's called acculturative stress. That's a term from John Berry's acculturation model developed in the 1990s. Berry identified four strategies: integration, assimilation, separation, and marginalization. Separation is when you maintain your heritage culture and reject the host culture. Marginalization is when you reject both, and that's the worst outcome by every measure. But the key finding from Berry's work and decades of follow-up research is that the enclave provides a buffer.
A buffer against what, specifically?
Loneliness, discrimination, the sheer cognitive exhaustion of operating in a second language all day. There's a study by Colleen Ward and Anthony Kennedy from 1994 that tracked immigrants across multiple host countries. They found that the first 2 to 5 years are the hardest, psychologically, and that immigrants who have a coethnic support network report significantly lower rates of depression and anxiety during that window. The enclave is basically a decompression chamber.
The Irish pub in New York isn't just a place to get a Guinness. It's a mental health intervention.
The Irish American pub network in Boston and New York is actually a textbook case of an ethnic enclave economy. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, Irish immigrants dominated bar ownership and the liquor trade. It created a parallel economy that absorbed newcomers, gave them jobs, gave them social connections, gave them a place where they weren't the outsider. But it also had a cost. It delayed integration into broader American professional life, sometimes by a generation or more.
You see the same pattern in Israel with the Anglo community.
American immigrants in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem have built a whole parallel infrastructure. WhatsApp groups for Thanksgiving dinners, English language parenting forums, American-style bars and restaurants. There's a whole neighborhood in Jerusalem, the German colony and Baca area, where you can go days without speaking Hebrew. And that's not a criticism. For many people, that community is what makes the transition survivable.
Then you have the other type. The ones Daniel described, where you don't even realize they're native English speakers until someone mentions it.
The stealth immigrants. And this is where the economic data gets really interesting. The Portes and Jensen study from 1989, the one that coined ethnic economy participation, they studied Cuban immigrants in Miami's Little Havana. They found that Cubans who worked within the ethnic enclave had unemployment rates 40% lower than Cubans who tried to enter the mainstream Miami labor market.
40% lower unemployment? That's enormous.
But here's the flip side. Their average incomes were 15% lower than Cubans who worked outside the enclave. So the enclave protects you from joblessness, but it caps your earning potential. You're trading income for security.
That's the trade-off in a single number. 15% less money, but dramatically more stability.
That's just the first generation. The really fascinating data comes when you look at what happens to the children.
Right, because Daniel's question is ultimately about whether the strategy you choose actually matters for long-term outcomes. If it all evens out by the second generation, then the whole debate is just about personal comfort for the first few years.
It doesn't even out. Portes and Ruben Rumbaut developed segmented assimilation theory in the 1990s and 2000s, and they identified something called the second generation advantage, but also its opposite, downward assimilation. Children of enclave-focused immigrants often retain their heritage language, which is a genuine cognitive and cultural asset. But they also face discrimination when they leave the enclave, and they sometimes struggle to access the same educational and professional networks that children of assimilated immigrants do.
What about the other side? The kids whose parents went full immersion?
They report higher educational attainment on average, but they often lose the heritage language entirely. There's a study by Alba and Nee from 2003 that looked at Italian Americans. They compared Italian families who stayed in ethnic neighborhoods like Boston's North End with those who suburbanized and assimilated. The second-generation Italians who left the enclave had higher incomes, but they reported weaker family ties and a weaker sense of ethnic identity. So you're trading connection for mobility.
It's the same trade-off, just playing out across generations instead of years.
The data gets even more specific when you look at Israeli immigrants in the United States. There was a 2019 study by Yinon Cohen and Yitzhak Haberfeld that compared Israeli Americans in Los Angeles who stayed within the Little Israel community in the San Fernando Valley with those who anglicized their names and joined mainstream American professional networks.
Let me guess. The anglicized group earned more.
30% more on average. But they scored 15% lower on a sense of belonging scale. That's the tension right there. More money, less belonging. And that's not a trivial metric. Sense of belonging correlates with everything from physical health outcomes to longevity.
The answer to Daniel's question, does one group report higher satisfaction, is that it depends on when you ask and what you mean by satisfaction.
The German Socioeconomic Panel, which is one of the longest-running longitudinal studies in the world, has been tracking immigrant integration since 1984. It's an incredible dataset. And what it shows is that there's an inflection point around year 7. In years 1 through 5, enclave dwellers report significantly higher life satisfaction. They have community, they have support, they're not constantly exhausted by navigating an unfamiliar culture. But after about 7 to 10 years, the immersionists pull ahead.
What happens at year 7?
Language fluency plateaus for the enclave group if they haven't been actively learning and their professional networks remain limited to the ethnic economy. Meanwhile, the immersionists have built enough host country social capital that they're no longer lonely, and their economic advantages start compounding. By year 10, the immersionists report higher life satisfaction and significantly higher income.
The immersion strategy is a long-term investment with a brutal upfront cost.
That's exactly what it is, and that's why I find Daniel's framing so honest. He said he'd hesitate to recommend the immigrant process even though he doesn't regret it himself. That's the ambivalence of someone who understands the cost.
The thing that strikes me is how rational both strategies actually are. The popular narrative, especially in countries with strong assimilationist traditions, is that immigrants who don't assimilate are refusing to integrate, that they're rejecting the host country.
That's a major misconception, and the data really pushes back on it. Ethnic enclave formation is often a completely rational response to discrimination and lack of access to host country social capital. It's not a rejection. It's a survival adaptation.
If you can't get a job through the mainstream network because nobody knows your last name and your credentials don't transfer, of course you're going to work for someone who shares your language and trusts your community.
France is a fascinating case study in this. France has a strongly assimilationist republican model. The official ideology is that everyone is French, period, and ethnic or religious distinctions are not recognized in public life. But the outcome has not been the smooth assimilation the model predicts. Instead, you've had enclave formation in the banlieues, the suburbs around Paris, that is more segregated and more economically isolated than what you see in countries with explicit multicultural policies. Canada is the counterexample. Canada's official multiculturalism policy, which was enacted in 1971, explicitly encourages immigrants to maintain their cultural heritage while participating in Canadian society. And the data shows that this integration approach, Barry's integration strategy, produces better outcomes on almost every metric than either forced assimilation or enclave separation.
The host country's posture matters enormously.
It shapes which strategies are even available. If you're an immigrant in Japan, the full immersion option is extremely difficult because Japanese society has strong ethnic boundaries around who counts as Japanese. You can learn the language perfectly, you can live there for decades, and you'll still be treated as an outsider. In that context, forming ethnic enclaves is less a choice and more the only viable path to community.
Which brings us to the new wrinkle, the digital nomad.
This is where the whole model gets complicated in ways we're only starting to understand. Post-2020, we've seen a massive increase in remote workers who don't need to integrate economically at all. They can live in Portugal or Thailand or Mexico, earn their income from a U.S. or European company, and never learn the local language or build local professional networks.
They're not immigrating in the traditional sense. They're relocating their body while keeping their economic life in the country of origin.
Early data suggests this group forms enclaves at much higher rates than traditional economic immigrants. Portugal's D7 visa program, which is designed for remote workers and retirees, has produced concentrated communities of English-speaking expats in Lisbon and Porto, who often have almost no interaction with Portuguese society beyond transactional exchanges at restaurants and shops.
There's something almost post-geographic about that. You're physically in one place, but socially and economically in another.
The research on this is still very thin because it's a phenomenon that really accelerated in 2024 and 2025. But the limited data we have suggests these digital nomad enclaves are different from traditional ethnic enclaves in one crucial way. They're not formed in response to discrimination or lack of opportunity. They're formed because there's simply no economic pressure to integrate.
Which might make them more pleasant in the short term, but more isolating in the long term. If you never need to learn the language, you never do. And then 10 years later, you realize you've been living in a country where you can't read the street signs.
That's not hypothetical. I've seen anecdotal reporting from places like Medellin, Colombia, and Bali, Indonesia, where digital nomad communities have created what are essentially parallel cities within cities. English language co-working spaces, English language gyms, English language dating scenes. The locals call them bubbles, and not always affectionately.
Where does all this leave the actual immigrant who's trying to make a decision? Daniel's question is ultimately practical. If you're moving to a new country tomorrow, what should you do?
The data is pretty clear that the optimal approach is neither pure enclave nor pure assimilation. It's Barry's integration strategy. Maintain your cultural connections, don't abandon your heritage, but actively invest in host country social capital. Learn the language seriously. Join local professional associations. Build mixed friendship groups that include both co-ethnics and natives.
That's harder than either extreme. It's easier to just stay in the enclave. It's easier in a weird way to burn the boats and go full native. The middle path requires constant recalibration.
But it consistently outperforms the extremes on both psychological well-being and economic outcomes in the long run. There's a reason Barry called it integration and not assimilation or separation. It's the synthesis of both approaches.
There's a practical dimension to this for employers too. Companies like Google and Microsoft have what they call cultural onboarding programs for relocating employees. They explicitly address status loss and network rebuilding.
That's something most companies completely overlook. They'll handle the logistics, the visa, the moving truck, the apartment. But they don't address the psychological experience of becoming a zero in a new country. The employee arrives, they're disoriented, they don't know how to find a doctor or a mechanic, their professional reputation means nothing, and the company wonders why they're underperforming for the first year.
Some cities are actually ahead of companies on this. Toronto and Melbourne have neighborhood integration officers whose job is to facilitate mixed-use community events that bring immigrants and native-born residents together.
Melbourne is a great example because Australia, like Canada, has a points-based immigration system that explicitly favors people with language proficiency, education, and job offers. It's designed to select for people who are likely to integrate successfully, and then they back that up with community-level programs that make integration easier.
Compare that to Germany's experience with guest worker programs in the 1960s and 70s. The assumption was that Turkish workers would come, work for a few years, and go home. There was no integration infrastructure at all. And the result was multi-generational enclave formation that Germany is still dealing with 60 years later.
The German socioeconomic panel data I mentioned earlier, that's precisely the population it was originally designed to study. The long-term consequences of guest worker programs that treated immigrants as temporary labor rather than future citizens.
The policy implications are clear. If you want immigrants to integrate, you have to invest in integration infrastructure. And if you don't, enclaves aren't a failure of the immigrants. They're a failure of the host country's imagination.
That connects to something Daniel alluded to in his prompt that I think is worth naming explicitly. He said he moved to Israel for religious reasons, as a Jew. That's a different category of immigration than economic migration. When you're moving to a country because of a deep identity connection, the psychological dynamics are different. If you're a Jew moving to Israel, you're not just immigrating, you're making aliyah, which literally means ascending. The host society sees you as returning, not arriving. That changes the integration calculus dramatically. You're not trying to become Israeli. In some sense, you already are Israeli in the eyes of the state and the society. The question is just how long it takes for your Hebrew to catch up.
That's true for Israel, but it's also true in a different way for diaspora communities everywhere. An Irish American moving to Ireland has a different experience than a random American moving to Ireland. There's a homecoming narrative that smooths the path.
That's where the ethnic enclave can actually serve a positive bridging function rather than a separating one. The Irish pub in New York was a way station. First generation, you're in the pub. Second generation, you're in the police department or the fire department or city politics. The enclave was the launch pad, not the destination.
Which is exactly what Portes and Rumbaud found with the second generation advantage. If the enclave provides enough stability for the parents to invest in their children's education, and the children then have the linguistic and cultural fluency to navigate the mainstream, you get a genuine success story.
The problem is when the enclave becomes a trap rather than a launchpad, when the second generation doesn't have the skills or the opportunities to move beyond it. That's downward assimilation. And it happens most often in contexts where the host society is hostile and the enclave economy is the only economy available.
The question isn't really whether enclaves are good or bad. It's whether they're bridges or walls.
Whether they're bridges or walls depends partly on the immigrants, partly on the host country, and partly on something Daniel mentioned that I think is underexplored in the literature. The role of the immigrant's own personality and goals.
If you're an extrovert who thrives on novelty, full immersion might be easier for you. If you're more introverted, or you have a strong need for cultural continuity, the enclave might be the only thing that keeps you sane.
Berry's acculturation attitude scale, which is available online and is used in cross-cultural psychology research, actually measures this. It asks questions about how important it is to you to maintain your heritage culture and how important it is to you to adopt the host culture. Your answers place you in one of the four quadrants: integration, assimilation, separation, or marginalization. And the scale has been validated across dozens of countries and immigrant groups.
There's literally a test you can take.
And it's not just academic. Knowing your own acculturation orientation can help you make conscious choices about where to live, what kind of community to seek out, and how much effort to invest in language learning and local networking. It turns a vague anxiety into a concrete strategy.
That's the kind of practical tool I wish more people knew about. Instead, most immigrants just stumble into one strategy or the other based on circumstance and personality, and then wonder why they're unhappy.
Employers could use this too. If you're relocating an employee, ask them which acculturation strategy they're leaning toward. Offer resources for both paths. Some people want to be immersed immediately. Language classes, local mentors, the full dive. Other people need a soft landing with a co-national community. Neither is wrong, and forcing someone into the wrong strategy for their personality is a recipe for a failed relocation.
Let's talk about the timeline question more specifically. Daniel's been in Israel for a while now. He's past that initial window. Where would the data place him?
Without knowing his specific circumstances, if he's been here more than 7 years, he's likely past the inflection point where the immersion advantage starts to show up. But here's the thing. The data also shows that most immigrants don't follow a pure strategy. They mix and match. They might work in a Hebrew-speaking professional environment, but socialize primarily with English speakers. Or they might live in an Anglo neighborhood, but send their kids to Hebrew language schools.
The hybrid approach.
Which is just Berry's integration strategy by another name. And it's what most successful long-term immigrants actually do, regardless of what they call it.
One thing I want to circle back to is the age factor. Daniel mentioned that he moved as an adult. Does the data say anything about how age and migration affects these strategies?
It's one of the strongest predictors. A 2024 study by the Migration Policy Institute found that 68% of U.S. immigrants who arrived before age 15 report feeling fully American. For those who arrived after age 30, it's only 32%. The younger you are when you arrive, the more viable the immersion strategy is, simply because your brain is more plastic for language acquisition and your identity is less fixed.
32% versus 68%. That's not a small gap. That's a fundamentally different experience.
It explains why so many adult immigrants gravitate toward the enclave. It's not a character flaw. It's that full immersion as an adult is harder, and the psychological payoff is less certain. If you arrive at 35, you might never fully pass as a native, no matter how hard you work. The accent will linger, the cultural references will be slightly off, and you'll always know you're from somewhere else.
Which is why Daniel's description of the stealth immigrants, the ones whose Hebrew is so perfect you'd never guess, impressed him so much. Because he knows how rare and difficult that is.
It's impressive, and it usually requires a combination of factors. Arriving relatively young, having high language aptitude, and making a conscious decision to avoid the expat bubble. I've met people like that here in Israel. Americans who came in their early 20s, refused to live in Anglo neighborhoods, refused to speak English even when it would have been easier, and now, 20 years later, they're indistinguishable from native-born Israelis.
The boats approach.
It worked for them. But I've also met people who tried that and crashed. The loneliness was too intense, the identity confusion was too disorienting, and they ended up leaving or retreating into the Anglo community after a few miserable years.
There's survivorship bias in the stories we tell about successful immersion. We hear about the ones who made it. We don't hear about the ones who burned out.
And that's why the data is so important. The anecdotes are compelling, but they're not representative. The analyses and longitudinal studies give you the actual distribution of outcomes. And what they show is that the pure strategies, pure enclave, or pure assimilation, are both high risk. The hybrid approach is the safest bet for most people.
Which brings us to the bigger picture. Daniel's question about backward social evolution isn't just a personal concern. It's about to become a policy crisis.
The World Bank projects 200 million climate migrants by 2050. That's not people moving for a better job or a sense of identity. That's people moving because their homes are underwater or their farmland has turned to desert. And those migrants are going to arrive with zero social capital, zero language skills, and no choice about where they end up.
That number is hard to even process. 200 million people.
It's the entire population of Nigeria and Germany combined on the move. And if we can't figure out how to make integration work for voluntary immigrants who chose their destination and had time to prepare, how are we going to handle that?
The stakes of getting this right are enormous. Understanding whether enclaves are bridges or walls isn't academic. It's going to determine whether societies hold together or fracture.
The research we've discussed today gives us a roadmap. Invest in integration infrastructure. Don't force assimilation, but don't abandon immigrants to permanent enclave isolation either. Support the hybrid path. Acknowledge the zero feeling and build systems that help people rebuild their social capital faster.
One thing I'll add, and this is more personal observation than data, is that the zero feeling never fully goes away. You can be here 20 years, speak the language, have a career, have a family, and there are still moments where you realize you don't know something that everyone around you takes for granted. A children's song, a historical reference, the name of a politician from 30 years ago, the zero echoes.
That's beautifully put. And it connects to something the research calls identificational assimilation, which is Gordon's fourth stage. It's the moment when you stop thinking of yourself as a member of your origin group and start thinking of yourself as a member of the host society. And for many immigrants, that moment never fully arrives. They live in a permanent state of partial belonging.
Which isn't necessarily a bad thing. There's a whole literature on third culture kids and the advantages of being able to code switch between cultural frames. But it is a real thing, and it's part of the cost that Daniel was talking about.
It's a cost that doesn't show up in the economic data. You can have higher income, higher educational attainment, full professional integration, and still feel that echo of displacement. That's why the sense of belonging scores matter. They're measuring something real that income statistics miss entirely.
All right, let's pull this together. Daniel asked two questions. Do the two strategies have names, and does one group report higher satisfaction?
The names are ethnic retention or cultural preservation for the enclave strategy, and assimilation or acculturation for the immersion strategy. The umbrella framework is Berry's acculturation model, with its four quadrants of integration, assimilation, separation, and marginalization. And the answer to the satisfaction question is that it's deeply nuanced. Enclave dwellers report higher happiness in the first 5 years. Immersionists pull ahead after year 7 to 10 on both income and life satisfaction. But the real sweet spot is the integration strategy, maintaining your heritage while actively engaging the host culture. That hybrid approach outperforms both peer strategies on psychological well-being and comes close to the immersion strategy on economic outcomes.
If you're an immigrant or someone managing a global team, the practical takeaway is to be intentional about which strategy you're pursuing. Take Berry's acculturation attitude scale, figure out where you land, and then build a plan that's honest about the trade-offs.
If you're an employer, ask your relocating employees what they need. Some people want the soft landing with a co-national community, others want to be thrown into the deep end. Neither is wrong, but forcing someone into the wrong strategy is a guaranteed way to lose them within 2 years.
One open question I keep coming back to. If remote work means you never have to integrate economically, does the immersion strategy become obsolete for a whole class of immigrants? And if so, what does that mean for social cohesion in the countries that host them?
That's the question that's going to define the next decade of immigration research. The digital nomad phenomenon is still too new for us to have good longitudinal data, but the early signs suggest it's creating a new kind of immigrant who is physically present but socially absent. And that's going to create political tensions that we're only beginning to see.
Climate migration is going to add another layer. When people are moving out of necessity rather than choice, the psychological dynamics are going to be even more intense, and the need for effective integration strategies is going to be even more urgent.
The good news is that we have 90 years of research on this. We know what works. The question is whether we have the political will to implement it.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
Hilbert, what do you have for us today?
In the 1960s, a British horologist discovered a previously unknown clock in a remote Belizean village that used fermented soursop juice as its timekeeping fluid. The acidity of the juice corroded the mechanism at a predictable rate, making it accurate to within 4 minutes per day. The clock was lost again in 1972 when the village was relocated after a hurricane, and no photographs of it are known to exist.
I have so many questions about the soursop juice.
4 minutes a day is not what I would call accurate. This has been My Weird Props. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for that deeply perplexing clock fact. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps other curious minds find the show. And if you have a weird prompt you'd like us to explore, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We're at myweirdprompts.com and on Telegram and Spotify. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Talk to you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.